Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Coding 101 is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out the Braintree V.0 SDK. With one simple integration, you get every way to pay. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com/coding. And by DigitalOcean. Simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code C101 in the billing section for a $10 credit. Today on Coding 101, welcome to iOS. Welcome to Coding 101. It's the Twitch show where we let you into the wonderful world of the code monkey slash code warrior. I'm Father Robert Ballister, the digital Jesuit, and joining me as always is my super special, non-secret, totally permanent public co-host, Lou Maresca.
Padre.
That one did not roll off the tongue, Lou.
That was nice at the first part.
Yeah. Oh, but Lou, you know, it's been a while. We've been gone for a while. I had to do some traveling. You had to do some work. But I think we've got a cool module coming up here. We're going to be talking all about iOS. Are you excited?
Oh, super excited. It's about time we got to this platform that everyone seems to be using, but we've been ignoring.
Yeah. Oh, and it's funny because We know all the stats. We're geeks here on the TWiT TV network, here in the TWiT armor. We understand that there are more Android devices sold than iOS by a factor of what, four? But at the same time, every time we have this discussion, people say all the money in app development to be made in iOS. So even though this is about a year late, because people wanted this to be one of the very first modules we ever did, we're going to bring you iOS development with Todd Perkins. You may remember he was on a Wildcard episode not too long ago, and he gave us some of the secrets of an iOS developer, a self-taught iOS developer. But before we do that, Lou, you've actually got a very nice starting item here, and that is some good practices for people who want to teach themselves to code.
Absolutely. So we talked about principles before on how to become, you know, going from a coder to a programmer and that daunting task of learning to be so. And I think we talked about it in episode 66, where we wanted to kind of go over some items of how you become from a coder to a programmer and, you know, how to transition yourself. But we wanted to go over just kind of very similar steps and specific items and go over, you know, inside those details, like very high level. Like, for instance, believe in yourself. Like, that would be one of them. And there's a great article on Medium, that Medium's a great site to go to for like web development and all these different type of development techniques. And they had an article called How I Taught My Mom to Code. And I think that was very interesting because it takes a lot of the areas that I've been reading about how people learn versus, you know, how people learn to program, that sort of thing, and kind of blending them together. And it had some really good items that we wanted to go over.
Right. You know, one of the things about that believe in yourself, I see that in a lot of code self-help sites. And it sounds very new agey. It sounds like you're okay, you can do it. But I don't think that's the real message. The real message in believe in yourself is believe that you can figure out how to do what you want to do.
That's right.
And that's actually an absolutely vital step in learning how to teach yourself to code, because you will always come to a spot where you have no idea where to start. You're like, I don't know how this works. I don't know what code to use. I don't even know what calls to make here. But if you do that first step, you think to yourself, okay, I have no idea how to do it now, but if I sit down, I will eventually figure it out. And that is so important, because it's easy just to quit in the middle of the process. But let's go ahead and go to the first one. What's the first tip?
So obviously the first one we just talked about is believe in yourself. And like you said, it's sometimes a daunting task, because you've used to a computer just being kind of a consumption device, a place where you go and you read and you maybe play games on it, but you never really thought about actually programming it and getting it, you know, and actually making it learn and do things that you wanted to do. And sometimes, you know, the best thing to do when it comes to believing in yourself is to write down what you don't know. So maybe you don't know exactly how a program gets from text to it get to actually how the computer doing it. Maybe you don't know even what code is. So, I mean, you really just need to understand where you're starting at. And so that's where it comes down to writing that thing down and knowing where you need to jump in there.
Yeah, exactly. And I, you know, the longer you do it, the more you do it. And if you do it as a daily exercise, it's like any other piece of muscle memory. This is saying, okay, well, when I sit down, there's some things that automatically go onto my screen. There are some thoughts that automatically come into my head, and I automatically put myself into the framework of figuring out how to take a real-world question and put it into code. All right, what's next?
So like you just said, I guess the first one what we should have talked about is write code every day. And so the key here is, you know, code is a language, right? You're teaching a computer how to do something. And in order for you to learn that, just like you said, muscle memory-wise, is you have to practice. And the thing is, you're not going to practice without making mistakes. And that's kind of a key is, you know, becoming a programmer is just kind of surfacing the mistakes, you know, before when you're writing the code and or after when you're compiling the code. And so, you know, really just 10 minutes a day will, you know, of you just writing it over and over again, making the mistakes and kind of getting there will really help you out and learn it.
Exactly. All right. So once we've started coding every day and once we believe in ourselves and, you know, do that whole, if the universe will grant it to me, I will take it. No, but seriously, what comes after that?
So those, you just pointed out, those are really two hard ones, right? I mean, those, you believe in yourself and try it every day, right? I mean, those things are tough for people to do on many different levels, right? So, but the next one being is to learn by example. And this is kind of what we call the tutorial phase, is don't actually copy and paste things from, you know, things you find online, things you find in book. Actually type it out. And that could be part of your 10 minutes a day thing, is you're typing it out, you know, you're compiling it if you need to. You understand what you're typing line by line. What I like to do is I like to add comments. And this is kind of funny, is some people say too many comments is bad. But what I like to do is every line that I type when I'm learning something, you know, let's say assembly language or something, I like to actually put a comment next to it to say, this is why I'm doing this line of code. So I actually understand what I'm typing, what I'm doing. And that's important, because then you kind of understand every line that you're there going forward. And then you can remember, oh, yeah, I remember when I typed that and it's to write out to the console or to give a message to the user. I'll just do it that way again, right? And so you'll remember that. You can go back and look for your example. And it's very important, I think, understanding every line of the code.
You know, when I was still teaching C, one of the things that I would have my students do is, even though they would be copying an example from another file, I never allowed them just to copy and paste. I said, type it as you see it. Because two things will happen. One, you'll kind of start to commit all those lines to memory. You'll commit the syntax to memory. But also, you'll make mistakes. When you're not copying and pasting, you'll make mistakes. And then when it compiles, you'll go, oh, okay, that's what that kind of mistake looks like. And then down the line, when your program is much more complicated and you see that kind of a compiler mistake, you go, oh, it's probably this. I've seen that before.
And your brain will start to recognize patterns, too. So like I said, you wrote to the console or you saved a variable data, piece of data to variable. I mean, your brain will start to recognize the patterns. So that's important. And they have other patterns when you do blocks of code. They call it design patterns, because you can remember, you know what, in order for me to loop or iterate over something, I do this, right? And so I use this design pattern to do that sort of thing. So that's very important also when you're coding, because a lot of developers, especially in big corporations, is they use design patterns. So it's a universal language amongst patterns across multiple different languages. So it's very important to recognize.
You know, something else that I've told people to do in the commenting phase is especially comment when you have no idea what a line or a function does. And it's like, it looks stupid to put it there, but no, seriously, put it in big letters. I don't know what this does. And what that does is it gives you a cue when you come back over it again to go, oh, now I understand this. Or I still don't understand this. I need to look this up. All right, so now that we're actually into coding, one of the things that I've heard a lot from students, Lou, is they're afraid to ask, especially when they get to that point in a course where they're saying, I think this was covered on day one, but I can't remember it. And they spend hours and hours, or they even come to that point where they give up because they don't want to ask a stupid question. Do you find that a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I find it even meaning sometimes. People are, you know, they sit in the corner and they might be really intelligent, but they maybe just be slightly intimidated by their company, maybe by the experience that's in the room. And they don't necessarily ask the question. And like I like to say is there's never a stupid question. Maybe there's a question that might waste a little bit of time, but I don't think there's ever a stupid question, right? So I think that that's the key is you know, if you don't get it, you should ask. And maybe you don't ask during the meeting, maybe you ask after, but never be intimidated to actually ask that question, because that will be maybe your point where then you start to believe in yourself, that you understand some things and you're starting to recognize patterns and these questions are coming up in your head. Maybe there's answers somewhere you need to find, but you don't know where to go. And so that's where those, you know, asking the questions is the first step.
The favorite question I have ever asked, I remember this. I was part of a dev team and I had to say, okay, guys, don't think I'm that stupid, but this works. I have no idea why it works. Can someone tell me what I did that made this thing work? Because I can't figure it out. And actually, that's a corollary to the ask questions tip. And that is, what kind of questions should you be asking?
Right. So that, again, sometimes you need to learn to ask the right questions. So, you know, like you said, everyone gets stuck at some point and you need to kind of understand how to get your self unstuck. And so, you know, writing things down to help you determine that. Maybe asking a friend or somebody who's an expert. Again, there's an old saying is, you know, somebody who copies somebody is a sign of, you know, that you trust them and that you look up to them. Another thing is emulating people is sometimes can make you successful too. So emulating really good code and understanding how they did it and how they get beyond those problems. Because a lot, you know, you got to remember, there's a lot of programming problems out there today, and a lot of people have solved these things. So you're going to be able to find these things in communities like out on the web. And I think one of them was, you know, take advantage of your resources. So for instance, you can go to GitHub or Stack Overflow or Bitbucket, you know, YouTube. There's sometimes online videos, lynda.com. It doesn't matter where you go. You can sometimes get over the hump of not understanding by using these resources. Also using people, using the community, using asking questions on Reddit. Might even get you kind of through. There's a lot of programming things on Reddit. So there's a lot of, like, coming to our Google Plus community, asking questions there, right? So I think it's really just finding a place to join a community of people and getting yourself unstuck and not being afraid to do so.
Lou, last tip, and this goes, again, hand in hand with all those resources you just mentioned. It can actually be counterproductive to try to take in all the potential sources of information you have. There are so many good resources out there, GitHub and Rewrite and even our community. But ultimately, one of your tips is you should have a guru. You should have someone you can go to, your go-to person, when you get stuck, who can at least help you get the best of the good resources.
Absolutely. And, you know, I have some great examples in my career where, you know, when I started, I didn't know what .NET was or anything. I used to code in C and C++ in college. And so coming here, it was a little daunting to understand where I needed to start. It's a different framework. And, you know, even just design patterns. I never really learned too many of them in college. And so these are all important things when you're going to a large corporation. They use a lot of. And so so I needed somebody to help with. And so I found a developer. He was around for a while. But he was always, you know, he might have been rough around the edges and, you know, socially. But when it came to me asking questions, he would always go deep. He always explained, take the time to explain it to me. He would take his personal time to show me examples and ways that were done inside the corporation. And these are all very important things when it comes to not a coach, but a coach, but also a mentor in some sense, right? So I think that, you know, you find somebody who really knows what they're doing. I found people on Twitter who really know web development and JavaScript and so on. And I ask questions. And again, you can't be afraid to ask the questions. And sometimes you'll find that, you know, more people are willing to help and willing to coach you along than the people are not. And I think that that's kind of the key. And don't be discouraged when you find that person that's not, because there are some of those. But I found that there's more than that. And so I think, you know, again, you can go to boot camps and you can get yourself kickstarted. But sometimes you need somebody to just kind of drive you through and get you over those humps when you're running into roadblocks. And I think that's where the coach comes in.
Sometimes you do need someone to get you over those humps, someone who can coach you, which is why we're going to have Todd Perkins on in just a bit to kickstart us into iOS. But before we do that, let's go ahead and thank the first sponsor of this episode of Coding 101. And let me ask you this. I mean, you are a developer. If you're watching the show, by definition, you're either a developer or a budding developer, a developer in training. And at some point, you are going to go past the rudimentary programs into something that you want to give to the world, and you're also probably going to want to get a little something back. Well, if you want to do that, if you want to set up a financial transaction system, you could go the old-fashioned route. The way that I had to do it, in fact, the way that Lou had to do it way back in the day when we didn't have modern resources, stand up your own financial transaction server, be secured, and make sure that you maintain that security. Oh, and don't forget to make an agreement with some sort of payment processor so that you can accept commonly used payment types. Yeah, you could do all of that and then worry about you getting hacked or losing financial information. Or you could just go to Braintree. Braintree is the place to go when you want an easy-to-integrate financial transaction system for your mobile app. Braintree is code for easy online payments. If you are building that app, you can use their V.0 SDK, which makes it easy for you to accept multiple mobile payment types. You could start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and more, all with a single integration. And when I say single integration, I really mean single integration. Remember what I was talking about, standing up your own financial transaction server and making those agreements with financial payment services? No. This is 10 lines of in-app code. Just 10 lines, and you're ready to go. That's minutes before you're ready to accept payments. Now, if you don't have the time, you could even give them a call, and they'll walk you through the integration. It's brain-dead simple. If you're not using Braintree, it means you're working too hard. Now, the Braintree code supports iOS, Android, and JavaScript clients. It's available in 7 different languages: .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. It's elegant code with clear documentation, so you'll never be lost. This is not one of those services that says, well, just put this code in here and it's a black box. No, they tell you exactly how it works. They tell you how it will integrate with your application. And with those 10 lines of in-app code, you're ready to go and ready to accept payments before you know it. Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with that integration. They give you quick, knowledgeable developer support. They let you start accepting all the payment types that your customers, that your audience wants to use. There's really no reason not to use Braintree. And with that Braintree V.0 SDK, with that one small snippet of code, you'll be up and running in minutes. Need more reasons to use Braintree? Well, how about this? If you learn more by going to braintreepayments.com/coding, you can get your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. That's right, folks. Are you out of excuses yet? Because if you are, you need to go to braintreepayments.com/coding. That's braintreepayments.com/coding. And we thank Braintree Payments for their support of Coding 101. Lou, what about it? Shall we jump ourselves into some iOS?
Let's do it. I'm ready.
We are very, very happy to welcome back to Coding 101, Mr. Todd Perkins.
Thank you, Padre and Lou. We're here at the coding desk, and we welcome back to the show Mr. Todd Perkins. He is our iOS guru. You may remember him from an interview we did a few weeks back where he told us about how he traveled into the world of iOS. Todd, thank you very much for coming back onto the show.
Thank you.
Now, this is a segment, a module that we have been waiting for a while because people have been wanting to program for iOS and we've been dancing around it, showing them some of the different frameworks that they could use to get close. But you are actually going to show us how to use a framework like Xcode to get your hands dirty. I think we need to start there because if they're going to download something right now, it's going to be Xcode, right?
Yes, definitely.
All right. So guide us through the process.
Okay. Do you want to see my screen?
Here we go.
All right. You can get Xcode from the Mac App Store. And I would say the system requirements right now, except if you're listening to this later on down the line, that might change. So you just want to go to the Mac App Store and search for Xcode. So it's all one word, and you should see it right there. And when you click on Xcode, you're going to see the install link. Mine says open because I've already installed the current version of Xcode. If you do have Xcode, you want to make sure that you install the current version. So right now, at the time of this recording/live stream, we're looking at Xcode 6.3.2. So download the latest one, and then you can see the software requirements on the right side of the screen. So yeah, I've already installed Xcode. Oh, was there something?
No, I was just saying, is it two different versions of Xcode? Like, does it come out as separate installs, or do you ever just upgrade the one that you have? It's just normally upgrade in place upgrade.
Yeah, it's an in-place upgrade.
Okay, got it.
So
the store should tell you when it needs to upgrade at that point.
Yep, the store will tell you, and I think they usually update it about once a month. Updates about once a month, and they change the code templates a little bit, so it won't break your code, but you might notice like errors or warnings or something like that in a new version, especially if you're using Swift instead of Objective-C. And that's why I've chosen to teach Objective-C, because when you go through this tutorial, it might be the language might be different and the templates might not work and the code that I write might not be accurate a couple months from now.
Now, Tal, we've got some of the people in the chat room who are already freaking out. We've got JJ to the 4884 and Elise, who are all saying, wait a minute, this is only for the Mac. And unfortunately, if you're going to be developing for iOS, there are a few options. In fact, Lou showed a few options for using the Visual Studio for doing it. But this is Mac, right? We are talking for Mac people.
Yes. I don't know. I didn't think to mention that. But yeah, we're definitely Mac only on Xcode.
Which is okay, because we've done a lot of languages that really only work well either in Linux or in Windows. So, hey, Windows people, bear with us, because these lessons are still going to work for you. This knowledge is still going to be important for you, even if you don't have a Mac. It's easier if you do.
Yeah, the code is going to apply, but some of the Xcode interface stuff, like laying out all the UI elements and everything, that's obviously Xcode specific. But all the code will apply in Objective-C, you know, anywhere you write it. So,
All right, let's start from the basics. We've got Xcode loaded on your Mac or on my virtual machine here. Where do I go from here? If I wanted to create my very first program, I wanted to jump into a hello world, what am I looking at? Show me what this context looks like.
Okay, so I have Xcode open already. So obviously, you're going to launch the application and you're going to get the, you're not going to get the warning because you're downloading Xcode from the Mac App Store. So never mind. I'm talking about old rules and old versions and everything. So you open up Xcode and you're going to see a bunch of code that was from another file. There we go. You're going to see this is the welcome screen right here. One of the cool features, again, we're not going to be talking about Swift right now. I mean, I guess if people want to see Swift, I can write some Swift code. I really don't mind.
You spoke about Swift before in your wildcard interview where it's a good language, but right now it's just changing too much for you to dedicate too many of your resources to.
Yeah. It's not really significant changes. Like if as just like a regular coder, you're not going to, have to throw your hands up in the air, all the time. But as a teacher of it and something where my code has to sit online and remain and where I record movies for a living, the movies become inaccurate with every change that they make to Swift. And so, they're really small changes like changing a question mark character to an exclamation point. But, for me, someone who's teaching it, when somebody sees inaccurate code on their screen, that's a problem. And so... So that's why I'm a little bit wary. I'm not wary about using it so much as I am about teaching it, if that makes sense.
Well, even changing just a question mark to an exclamation point, it's a syntactic tool change. That breaks everybody's code, right? Not just yours.
Yeah. It's going to break the code. It's a really easy fix, but I'm mostly worried about it for like teaching purposes. And same thing right now. If I were to teach it right now, I don't want to show you guys inaccurate code. Those who are watching this that aren't watching it live, I don't want to give you inaccurate code, and so...
Absolutely. So we'll stick with the iOS Objective-C app then, right? There's a way to create those specifically?
Yeah, you can even mix and match the code if you choose. One of the cool options with the new version of Xcode is that there's a button that says Get Started with a Playground. And a playground is really cool because it gives you feedback about your code while you're writing it. So you'll write like one line of, and it only works in Swift, and that's why I'm not going to show it. I just want to talk about it for a second. It only works in Swift, but it can process lines of code like as you write it. So you write math or something like that, or a mathematical formula, and you can see the result of the formula on the right side of the screen without having to compile. So it's really good for just, it says on here, explore new ideas quickly and easily. So you're trying to work out a formula for a game or something like that, then it's really useful. So going back to creating a new Xcode project. So you can create a project by clicking the button. And an Xcode project is a folder on your computer. And there's one file associated with that. It's the Xcode project file. And you can double-click that to open up your project. But what you're really creating is a folder with all the classes and everything, just like any other language. So when you click to create a new project, you're going to see two sections, iOS and OS X. And of course, if you want to create an iOS application, you're going to be looking under here in the application setting. And you're not going to see these Cocos 2D templates unless you've installed them previously. That's a third-party template that I installed in Xcode.
So even though this window seems really simple, sometimes it's kind of confusing to tell what do you need to pick and why.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Because if you want to make an iOS app, you're going to be on application. But maybe you want to make something a little bit more complicated, like coding frameworks and that kind of stuff. If you're going to make your first, your Hello World app, you want to come under iOS to application. And the simplest one is single view application. So I'm going to go through that and I'm just going to click next. And here we have to put some settings for our project. And so I'll give this a name. I'll call this Hello World. Spaces are okay in a project name. And then I put my organization name, which is just my name. And then organization identifier. Actually, this doesn't really matter what you put here until you publish the app to the App Store. This is so that my Hello World app that launches in the App Store can be differentiated from someone else's app with the same name in the App Store.
They usually call it what they call it, a reverse URL, right? Or reverse URL. Yep.
Exactly. So my website is toddperkins.com, and so I'm using com.toddperkins. So those flipped. Yep. And then here you can choose the language, and this is where you choose Swift if you want to use Swift. But I'm going to choose Objective-C for now. And
when you choose that, do you have to go back? If you want to do Swift in your app later on, do you actually have to change something to do that, or you have to create a new project, or it has to be?
That is actually just in your code. You can use Swift and Objective-C together.
Okay.
You can access Swift libraries through Objective-C and vice versa.
Okay, so this is just the project that gets created. The first code file you see will be Swift or Objective-C, but you could switch intermittently if you needed to.
Yeah. It's not like you just flip a switch to, make an existing code file turn into a different language, but you can access your Objective-C code from Swift and your Swift code from Objective-C, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And so for devices, you can choose iPhone, iPad, so you can specifically target a device, or you can go to Universal, which applies to both. And so what that's going to do is it's going to use Xcode's like user interface settings to either adapt one layout, or you can create multiple layouts and have an iPhone specific layout and an iPad specific layout.
Let me ask you about that. In your experience, is it better to make one that's specifically for the iPhone and one that's specifically for the iPad, or to try that universal layout where it's trying to give you elements of both?
I think for your first app, iPhone, just choosing one is better. I like choosing iPhone. Maybe iPad might be easier because they're the same aspect ratio across all devices. But universal is good because you can still have all the power to create different layouts for different apps. It just saves it all into one file. So yeah, I would say universal is better if you're planning on making a universal app.
Okay. All right.
And then you don't have to manage multiple code bases and link up projects to each other and stuff. And you don't want to do that. So I'll click next. And And okay, I'll just create a Hello World project. So I'm just going to a folder on my computer and we'll call this Hello World. And okay, so here I'm taken into Xcode. And this is our first project. And I'm going to expand the window. So I'm going to put this up in the top left corner and then drag from the bottom right corner and expand my whole area here. So at this point, we can build the application and test it out, and it's not going to be very interesting. The single view at, oh yeah, go for it.
So did create some files on the side over there though. That this is like the view of your project, I guess, from this point.
Yeah. A folder has been created on my computer and several files in there. Do you guys want to see that? Is that worth looking at? Maybe?
Absolutely. I think we can kind of see it from here, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you just look at documents and then pop, there we go. So Hello World, this is the folder that I just created. And then this is the project file. So it's the exact same name as my project if you look over here. So Hello Space World. And it creates some subfolders. And where everything is going to reside is in this Hello World subfolder. And if you look at the project navigator on my screen, you'll see that there's a Hello World. It looks like a folder, but it's actually kind of confusing the way the Xcode handles it. It is not an exact mirror of your file system, what you're seeing right here. This is Xcode can organize files independently. And what you see is this gold folder is actually what is called a group in Xcode. And so that's where you group files that are not necessarily organized into folders on your computer.
Got it.
This Hello World.xcode project is sort of like the file that you double click on to your working file, you know, like a PSD in Photoshop or something like that. You're going to double click this file to open up your project in Xcode. So let's head on back to Xcode. At this point, we could actually build and run the application and see what it looks like in the simulator. And let's do that real quick, and then we'll make some changes.
Okay.
And you guys can feel free to stop me. This is actually taking a lot longer than I had planned, so feel free to stop me to pause for another episode or whatever needs to happen.
No, you keep going.
Okay, cool. Okay, so to execute your application and actually see it in the iOS simulator, all you have to do is click this play button. And so this is going to build your application. So if you're not familiar with that, it's going to take all of your human-readable code in your app, and it's going to turn it into machine-readable code into a little application file, and then it's going to open up the iOS simulator and show you that application. And now you want to make sure that you have the appropriate simulator selected here. So next to your Hello World application in the toolbar, you're going to see the simulator that's going to launch when you click the Run button. So you can click on that and choose the appropriate one. So there's a whole bunch of them here.
Yeah, I'm going to ask if they had the old phones in there too, but that's cool.
Yeah, they do. They have some of the old ones. I have all the way back to the iPhone 4S and the iPad 2. So for this one, I'm going to choose iPhone 6. And if you're trying to follow along, you can do the same thing. And then I'll just click the Run button. And at this point, it's going to launch after a few seconds on my computer because I actually already opened up the iOS simulator. But when it initially launches, you might have to wait maybe up to like 1 minute. And so there it is right there. And we have the Hello World screen and then just a blank application. And this is... it's working just like it's supposed to. Now, you may not see exactly what I see on my screen. So you might, the iOS simulator window might be larger than your screen has to accommodate it vertically. And if you're finding that is a problem, then you can go under Window and then Scale and then reduce the scale settings, or of course, use the keyboard shortcuts, Command 1 through 5, to adjust it accordingly. So I can shrink it down to 50% if I want. But for my screen, 75% fills pretty much the whole window. So that's what I want.
Cool.
Let's see. Yeah, that's really all we need to talk about with iOS Simulator for now. If you wanted later on, you know, you want to test other apps, you can go under hardware and rotate it and perform a shake gesture, a home button simulation, a lock button simulation. You can reboot it, all that stuff. So that's accessible through this menu, which is for the iOS simulator. So just remember that this is not the Xcode app that we're looking at right now. This is the iOS simulator application. So when I click back and make Xcode the focus, you're going to see that it changes from iOS simulator to Xcode. So you have a whole different set of settings, and I can no longer, you know, adjust the scale through the window mode like I did on the simulator.
Yeah, that was actually a question that Gojira Rocks in our chat room wanted to know. If you wanted to know if the simulator was actually part of Xcode, they would download that separately, right?
No, they don't have to download it separately. So it's just a sub application that's kind of bundled with Xcode.
Oh, okay.
But if you look down in my doc, you'll see that there is actually an iOS simulator app that's running separately from the Xcode app, which is right here.
All right, so we saw a very basic application. Can you actually show us the code that made it?
Yeah. We have three different things. We have an app delegate class, we have a view controller class, and then we have what's called a storyboard. So I'm going to walk through those one by one. The app delegate class is made up of two files. So there's the header file, which basically declares properties and methods. And then we have the implementation file, which actually says what happens in the code. Now, you're noticing that I have this code wrap on line 18 here. And let's see if I can get a little bit more space. And in order to get more space, I'm going to hide the utilities area. That's this whole set of stuff on the right side of the screen that's not relevant to our code. So to hide it, I'm going to click that button. There's a set of three buttons at the top right to show or hide these views. I'm going to hide the utilities area like that. So that looks a little bit better to me. So the app delegate file is something that you don't have to write code in. This is the code that executes if you want to do something special when you launch the application. It's not really the default place to write your code. Let's say I had that the iOS application in the simulator, there's a blank screen on there. And let's say I put like a text label in there and I wanted to edit the text label with code. I wouldn't do that in here. There's a separate code file for that. This is for more general stuff. Like I'm going to initialize services and everything in this file. And so I have methods that are built in like this. Application did finish launching with options. So once the app launches, I can write code in this existing method, and this will execute then. I can write code in here. Application will resign active. This is like when somebody, it says the whole explanation right here. When the application is about to move from active to an inactive state, this can occur for a whole bunch of different reasons, like getting a text message or a call or something like that. So you can save a state or pause your game, like it says here. Do whatever you want if the user is going to leave your application. And so same thing for application did enter background. So it's a similar method. And then we have the opposite of those, which is did enter foreground and did become active and will terminate. So you can control, you know, when you're going to save data, when you're going to load data, when you're going to refresh data, all that kind of stuff through this class.
So, Todd, maybe we could talk about these a little bit later, but I wanted to, I'm just curious. So basically iOS lets you run this code if you, like you said, go back to like the start screen or something like that. They actually let you run a piece of code before that happens?
Yeah, exactly. So you're not going to be able to like hijack the operating system or anything, but you can have your app kind of save some stuff in the background for sure. Yeah.
Got it. So there's like maybe, is there a limited amount of time they give you, or is it a certain amount of space or CPU time, or is it like limited to how much processing power you can do in that little space there in that function call?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what you're limited to, you know, what the time limit is or anything, but you do have, you know, you can't take forever. You know, when you hit the home button, the app needs to, you know, go over to something else. But yeah, you can like save a file to like a URL or something like that, and it will work in these. So it could take a minute, because remember, like when you hit the home button on an application, the app kind of stays running in the background. So you can do a limited amount of stuff. So you can look at like this kind of stuff, you know, these method descriptions kind of explain a little bit about what you can do in those method calls.
Cool.
So the view controller class is, this is where you're going to write your basic code. So you're making a Hello World app. This is where you're going to want to come. And you'll notice right off the bat that it's a lot less complicated, or at least a lot less verbose than the app delegate class. So nice and clean for you to write simple code and find it easily. And so, yeah, this the view controller is what's connected to the storyboard. And the storyboard is your user interface for your application. So when I click, and you want to single click on these, because if you double click, you're going to open up these files in a separate window. And I don't even know why that exists, but it does. So in main.storyboard, I can see my, this is, so it says view controller, and which is the name of your, a user interface element in Xcode. So like a view is a user interface. Like this is a view, like a, just a blank white box that you see on the screen. And the view controller is the code that interacts with that, or the code that manages that, if that makes sense.
So this storyboard is just kind of like your palette for you to be able to just start building the interface, dropping stuff on there and putting fields and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And, it's as easy as you'd expect, but also a lot more complicated at the same time.
It always is.
Yeah. In older versions of Xcode, when you only had one size of iOS device, you know, just when it was an iPhone, you could just drag and drop all day long. But now it has to adapt to different sizes. So there's a bunch of different tools that help you to lay out a user interface that is fluid and changes as the you know, either the size of the screen or the orientation of the screen. Is it in portrait or landscape? And how do you handle that? All that kind of stuff. I'll show you a basic. We're going to come back to the when we actually build the app. We'll come back to this is called Interface Builder. It used to be a separate app, and now it's just baked right into the Xcode editor. So we'll come back into Interface Builder later on, when we build an application and do some more stuff. But for now, here's if you wanted to start fiddling around and having fun in Interface Builder, click the Utilities button at the very top right corner of the screen. So it should be blue. And I'm going to just click and drag in that separator. So when I hover over the separator, I have like an up and down arrow on my cursor. And I'll just click and drag that up. And if you click on the Library button, which is a circle with a square inside of it, you can see all the user interface elements and non-visual elements that you can just drag and drop right onto your screen. So if we wanted to, say, drag a text label onto the screen, I could scroll through here and look for it, or I can use the search field. And the search field is actually pretty convenient because, as you'll see, this list is kind of long. And if you know exactly what you're looking for, you can just type it in here, and Xcode is pretty fast with finding the appropriate tool. So I know I'm looking for a label, and I can just click on that label and just drag it right into my view here. And there's my label on the screen.
Is that freeform, or do you have to, is it kind of a grid and it kind of snaps the grid in the background there?
Yes. if I drag, you'll see that there's like certain kind of like helpers. It's not really a grid in the background, but there's helpers that say, okay, this is about how far away we recommend you have a user face element from the edge of the screen. So as you see, I drag right here, then I'm getting, you know, these kind of hinters, and my label's kind of locking to that. So as I'm moving my mouse slightly right now, if you can, I don't know if you can see that on the stream, but the label doesn't move when I move slightly. So it's locking to the corners. So all of those corners like that. And also you'll see you have some helpers for the center if you want to center something. I'm going to drop this over here. And to edit it, I can just double click the label and I can write a message.
That makes it what the default value that's in that field then? Or the default value for that label? Cool.
Right. Yeah. When I test the application, I'm going to see this. And now this is where it gets tricky. Depending on where you put this label, if you save the file and and it's not saved, I'll switch it real quick. Okay, there we go. I made a small change and then main.storyboard over here turned dark. And a dark file in Xcode in the Project Navigator means the file has not been saved. So you can just look right over there and see what's been saved, what's not been saved. So I'll save it with Command S or obviously file save, or you can just simply hit the run button and everything will automatically save anyway. So if I run the application, and I have to hit stop because I didn't click the stop button in Xcode when the other app was running. So I'll have to stop it and it'll rebuild and then run it again. And it's at the top, but if you put yours somewhere else on the screen, you might not see it there. And I think that's something I want to talk about in another segment because...
Sure.
I want to give a more of an overview of Xcode now. We can control, we can say that an object is so many points or pixels from an edge of the screen, or we can lock it to the bottom right corner, for example, and control that. So Interface Builder gives you a lot of control with that stuff. But I don't want to go too into that here. I meant to be doing just an overview of the entire interface. And I've kind of focused a lot on Interface Builder. Do you have any questions for me? Or
no, just this, Todd. Our audience is going to go home. And those people who have Macs or who have the ability to run a virtual machine are going to be able to download Xcode. And they're going to start playing around with this. What kind of homework would you like to give them? Because obviously you want them to be familiar with the interface, with the builder, before they actually start getting into the coding. What would you have them do over the next week?
Okay, so we stop here, and you're going to have some homework for the week. What I would say is just get Xcode, make your first project, and just mess around with Interface Builder for a little bit. Just try to build a simple layout for your application and try to get used to how it works. I'm going to show you one more thing so that you can get... a little bit more accurate with how you're testing out your layouts. And that is this W and H at the bottom center of the screen. So if I single click that, what this is it's approximating device aspect ratios. And so if I kind of mess around with this a little bit, you'll see that it says, okay, at the bottom, final values are for 3.5-inch, 4-inch, and 4.7-inch iPhones in landscape. And so you can adjust the size of this window to more specifically target the device that you're testing on and make sure that your layout in Xcode is a little bit closer to what you're going to actually see in the simulator when you run the application. So I would choose a device, for example... this one right here, which is going to cover a 4.7-inch iPhone, which I want to be using in my iPhone 6. And then if you notice, the interface changed a little bit. So that would be my homework, is just create a simple project, go into the storyboard, start dropping some user interface elements, and you can use this here and just kind of experiment with dragging the various elements onto the screen and seeing what you get when you test the application.
All right, so that's the stick. That's what you have to do. That's what we're threatening you with. But of course, with every stick needs to come a carrot. And if they do get familiar with this interface, what will they be doing next week?
Well, once they get familiar with the user interface, we're going to take a tour of the rest of Xcode and start writing some basic code and looking at how to connect these user interface elements to code.
Fantastic. That's Todd Perkins. He is a guru of ours for iOS. You could find him on lynda.com. He has some fantastic lessons. If you've got a Lynda subscription, download everything he does if you're even remotely interested in iOS programming. But Todd, where else can they find you? Because that's not your only outlet on the internet.
I am on Twitter. Ask Todd is my handle. So find me on there and send me praise, please.
We all like praise.
Yes, praise is great. So that's where you can praise me if you want to.
Fantastic. Until next time, we thank you very much for being our code warrior. Lou, Todd, I think we should go back to the desk to Lou and Padre.
We're going to wrap up in just a little bit. Todd's going to be coming back the next few weeks to give us more and more iOS goodness. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and thank the second sponsor of this episode of Coding 101. Let me ask you another question. We just talked about standing up your payment system, but what happens when you want to stand up your app? Again, you could go that old school route. You could buy a server in a data center. You could build out your own data closet. Maybe you need something more substantial in a colo, and then you have to worry about security. You have to worry about maintenance, and you have to worry about scalability. Yeah, you could do it that way if you have unlimited time and unlimited budget, or you could just go over to DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean is a place to go where you can stand up your app immediately and have it scalable to basically infinity. You see, they use droplets. Now, these droplets allow you to put your app, put your application, to put your development project in and have it immediately up and running on a virtual machine. Well, before you know it, it's built for developers and it's used by over 400,000 of them, including those of us here at Twit TV. We use it anytime we need to test a new deployment or if we want to maybe open something up to the public for just a while to see how it will stand up to abuse. DigitalOcean is great for everything from testing to full-on production. Now, you get to choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. They have a one-click install that allows you to deploy apps like Django, Docker, Drupal, LAMP, GitLab, MediaWiki, Node.js, WordPress, Ghost, Magneto, OwnCloud, Ruby on Rails, and more. All their servers are built on hex core machines with dedicated ECC RAM and RAID SSD storage. Servers can have up to 20 CPUs, 64 gigabytes of RAM, and 640 gigabytes of SSD space. It's highly scalable, which means it can meet the demands of a rapidly growing application or business. Start small, and then as you need more resources, pay for them. That means you don't ever have any unused iron lying around. You don't have unused clock cycles. You only pay for what you need. They give you auto backups and snapshots so you can clone, deploy, and resize droplets as you go. And you can deploy servers in regions all around the world with 99% uptime and gigabit speeds. They've got full-featured DNS management that lets you manage your domains, or you could use a dedicated IP. And with the web console access with HTML5 and also SSH, SFTP, KVM, VNC for virtual desktops, it means you can manage your projects, your applications, your servers from anywhere. Now, if you want an active community, you do want to come to DigitalOcean. They've got a community that will answer your questions and are more than happy to help you stand up your project. It's one of those little touches that makes them different from everybody else out there. And it's so easy to get started. You can deploy your own SSD cloud server in as little as 55 seconds. Here's what we want you to do. If you're serious about development, try DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean has incredible, affordable, and straightforward pricing. Servers start at only $5 a month. There's also hourly pricing available in case you just want to test an application. Stand it up for just a few minutes or a few hours. It starts at less than a penny per hour. But we're going to make it so that you can get started today and deploy an SSD cloud server for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. Once you confirm your email and account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code C101. For a free $10 credit. That's plenty to get started and explore what DigitalOcean can do for you. Whether you're a novice or an expert developer, DigitalOcean is something that you want in your tool chest. That's DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, enter the code C101 in the billing section for a $10 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for the support of Coding 101. Lou! This has been a crazy episode. Everything from 7 habits for highly successful programmers to the start of our iOS journey. Now, next week, he's going to be starting to get us into some of the topics that we've touched before. He's going to show us linking to objects. He's going to show us classes. What do you expect to see?
Yes, I think he's doing a really good job of starting from the beginning and kind of getting your hands dirty with the interface, because there's a lot of stuff going on there and people get confused sometimes of where to go, even if you've used things like Visual Studio or Eclipse or other programming IDEs before, where to get started, how to build things. It's important. But, you know, I think I do expect to kind of get into how to break up your code into classes, how to organize it, you know, single responsibility type principles, also how to build the UI and then connect the UI up to those classes and those objects. So those are all expectations, I guess, you expect from every type of development, from every platform. So hopefully he'll get into those soon.
Coming up on next week on Coding 101. Now, Lou, of course, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I mean, you are my co-host. You know what? You are Coding 101. I'm just the guy here who sits in front of the camera. But could you please tell the folks at home where they can find you? Of course, they're going to find you on Twitter, BlueMM. Of course, they're going to find you over at Microsoft. But if they wanted to take a closer look at your work, where could they go?
Well, all my work on the daily job that I have here at Microsoft, you can find me at crm.dynamics.com.
Thank you very much. Now, we'll see you next week. Don't forget to come back each and every single week so you can catch all the goodness. But if you can't watch us live, which, by the way, we do every Monday, 2:30 p.m. Pacific time, live.twit.tv. And as long as you're watching live, go ahead and jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv, and you can talk to us during the show. But if you can't catch us there, go to our show page at twit.tv/code. It actually got an overhaul along with the rest of the Twit TV website. You'll be able to find all of our episodes, download them so that you can watch them, listen to them at your own leisure. If you want to catch our previous modules on any of the languages that we've covered, from Perl and C Sharp to Java, you could just go there. Again, that's twit.tv/code. Also, don't forget that, you can find me on Twitter. Just go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you're going to find out what we're doing each and every single week. And it's also a really good place to give us feedback. If there's a topic you want us to cover, if there's a guest you want us to have, if there's a language you desperately need us to teach you, remember, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Finally, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, to Lisa and to Leo for letting us do Coding 101. Of course, to my co-host, Lou Maresca, and to my TD Eskimo Zach. That's right. You know him. You love him. He's the guy with the Eskimo name. Zach, could you please tell the folks where they can find you on the Twit TV network?
Thank you. You guys can find me on Twitter at Eskimo Zach. That's Zach spelled with an H.
Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballas here. This has been Coding 101. End of line.